Three Books is our new reading series in which we ask writers to recommend three great reads on a single theme. We are still in the sixth month of the year, June. It's the month of weddings. And writer Caroline Langston has three books that she says you should say, I do too.
When I was growing up in Yazoo City, Mississippi, my mother wasn't much into housekeeping or cooking, but she did teach me one thing, how to tell a real engraved wedding invitation. Southerners love weddings. There's a whole body of lore about weddings and how Iowa people do them, such as you don't send cards telling people where you're registered, and you never, ever have a cash bar at the reception. Now there is a handy guide for those who were raised elsewhere. Somebody is going to die if Lilybeth doesn't catch that bouquet, the official Southern lady's guide to hosting the perfect wedding. Written by Gaydon Metcalf and her fellow Mississippi Deltan, Charlotte Hayes, this book is both hilarious and a real practical resource, with recipes like sausage cheese balls and shrimp remoulade. While it's heavy on the social conventions of what some folks call whiskey-palians, it also makes a point I've not seen cited lately anywhere else, which is that a Southern Baptist wedding where no alcohol is served can be as high society and tasteful as anything else. Southerners also love weddings that are absolutely nothing like the ones they grew up with. One of the best portraits of a wedding that perfectly exemplifies its time and place is found in Philip Roth's wondrous 1959 novella, Goodbye, Columbus. Tag along with working-class librarian and ex-philosophy major Neil Klugman as he woos the careless Brenda Potemkin against the golf courses of Short Hills, New Jersey. Poor Neil still lives back in Newark, from which Brenda's family had fled after their bathroom sink business took off. And the whole novel is a study in the class rifts that money creates. When Brenda's brother announces that he will be getting married very suddenly, and this being the 1950s, you know why, Neil gets to participate in a lavish, all-night hotel wedding that underscores the rewards and the costs of making it out of the old neighborhood. For a more contemporary satire, go check out Suzanne Fenimore's 1999 novel, Otherwise Engaged. In it, 36-year-old protagonist Eve orchestrates getting her divorced live-in lover Michael to propose, then spends the rest of the volume running around San Francisco freaking out about the wedding. This book's been labeled chick lit, but it's a lot more thoughtful than that, with lots of digression about Michael's ex-wife and daughter, Eve's psychotherapy, and the amount of valium in the bathroom cabinet. Well before Carrie, Miranda, Samantha, and Charlotte, Eve is a successful advertising executive who drives a sports car and wears $20 Donna Karan hose, but is as earnest and as amusingly unhinged in her desire for marriage as anybody else. These days, there is no guarantee that our children will grow up to follow our wedding traditions or even will marry in the religion we raised them with, although I am trying hard on that one. I tell you one thing, though. My son will never have a cash bar at the reception.
Writer Caroline Langston lives in Cheverly, Maryland, and you'll find details about these three books, plus a recipe for that Southern wedding specialty, sausage cheese balls, in the book section of our website, npr.org.
And now, the secret of how a girl detective who first appeared in 1930 still endures today.
Hello, Captain Tweedy.
How did you get in here, Miss Troop?
Oh, the Turnbulls are friends of mine.
How is it every time there's trouble you turn up? What do you want?
We just wondered if you'd solved the case.
The long-suffering police chief of River Heights, USA, thought he had. But once again, it was Nancy Drew who would solve the secret of the hidden staircase. And she would follow the clue in the old album, decipher the password to Larkspur Lane, and crack the mystery of the moss-covered mansion. This morning, in the latest installment of our series In Character, we're hot on the trail of Nancy Drew.
I'm pretty sure I started at the beginning, The Secret of the Old Clock.
That's the first of dozens of Nancy Drew mysteries, in crime writer Laura Lippman's love of the girl sleuth put her on the path to creating her own best-selling series featuring gal detective Tess Monahan. Tess is a lot tougher, but she inherited Nancy Drew's need to find out.
One of the nice things about the Nancy Drew books is that it validates curiosity as a virtue, which was not always the message in a lot of things that little girls were told.
Look, whoever's been getting into this house hasn't been coming through the doors or windows, so it must be through this basement. How? I don't know. And that's why somebody has to be here.
Why can't that somebody be somebody else?
She does do things she's not supposed to do. For instance, her father is very often saying, Nancy, you just has nothing to do with you. You can just stop now. And then, of course, at least in the movies, she stands with her fingers crossed behind her back. So
I'd forgotten that. Well, you know, her father does encourage her to be adult-like and to use her mind. You know, it's interesting if you go back and look at children's literature, how many of the really popular books are designed so that parent figures are off stage. So Nancy begins without a mother at all, just this kindly housekeeper. She's really a free agent, and she's very much an autonomous person at the age of 16. And when you're a little girl of 10 or 11, that's just thrilling.
It's a secret door. That's what it is.
Look, there's no mortar in that crack. I think we're getting hot.
This is it, all right. The dust has been tracked away. Come on, start pushing.
I don't think there is a casual reader of Nancy Drew. There may be casual readers of Proust, but not of Nancy Drew.
Humorist Fran Lebowitz remembers she was obsessed with Nancy Drew and the entire cast of characters. Ned Nickerson, the sometimes useful kind of boyfriend, Hannah the housekeeper, father, Carson Drew, and Nancy's adoring girlfriends, Bess and George.
When I was maybe 7 or 8 years old, I had an operation on my eyes, and my eyes were blindfolded for 2 weeks, which compelled my mother to sit by my bedside and read me Nancy Drew books all day long, because I couldn't read myself. So that even blindness did not stop me.
The appeal?
She was a fantasy figure for girls, you know, because she had this independent life, which to me at that age primarily meant being a detective. But being a detective seemed to me like an excellent job. It still seems like a pretty good job. And I still would like to have a roadster, a blue roadster. I still have not acquired one.
That blue roadster, think about how liberating it was 8 decades ago. A girl in possession of her own car, the wind in her hair. Nancy Drew drove it everywhere, often recklessly, so focused was she on the mystery at hand. Here in The Secret of the Old Clock.
The blue convertible sped along the country road. Nancy smiled grimly. I'm afraid I'm exceeding the speed limit, she thought, but I almost wish a trooper would stop me. Then I could tell him what happened to the poor Turner sisters.
Over the years, Nancy Drew has shown up on TV, in the movies, comic books, and most recently, video games. Her roadster has been updated to a hybrid. Gone are the cloche hats and gloves from the 30s. But young readers like fifth grader Michaela Brown do appreciate the classic touches in Nancy's always adorable outfits.
In the newer books, she kind of wears more modern clothes, but she always has like a hint of vintage. There are pictures, of course, in the comic books, you know, because it's a comic book. And she was wearing this headband that was, you could totally tell that it was the 50s. You know, she always has like a hint of something else, which is kind of cool.
I don't know if she really ever carried a magnifying glass, but that was the idea.
Yeah.
You know, does she have ways of carrying things that only a detective would have on them?
In the newer book, she has a Swiss Army knife, and then she also has a keychain with a flashlight. I don't think anybody really carries around a Swiss Army knife.
Another fifth grader, Zoe Dutton, remembers how she was introduced to Nancy Drew. It was a hot day in the summer before she started second grade, and her mother handed Zoe a childhood favorite of her own, The Bungalow Mystery. Did you ever, maybe even when you were, you know, younger, actually try and solve a mystery?
No.
Kind of hard to come by.
Yeah. I mean, she's constantly stumbling on, like, smugglers and criminals and forgeries, and it's slightly unrealistic, but, I mean, only Nancy Drew can do this because she can sniff out a mystery like a bloodhound.
In fact, neither Zoe Dutton nor Michaela Brown want to be Nancy Drew. They'd rather have her as a friend, partly, says Zoe, because she's a little too perfect, which can be a little boring.
Her car is always fixed perfect. She's always nice to everybody. She's even polite to the criminals after she catches them and knocks them out. I mean, it's slightly ridiculous, but it's nice if you're her friend.
That empty shell I found yesterday was 4 1/4 belt lengths from the window where Phillips was discovered. If he had committed suicide, the shell would have fallen beside him. That proves he was shot from across the room.
As to why I love Nancy Drew, here's a clue from one of the old movies called Nancy Drew Reporter. Nancy is figuring out how she and Ned can sneak into a house that's a crime scene.
But what if you can get in? It's still illegal.
Not for a reporter. A reporter has the right to do things an ordinary person shouldn't.
Ah, fool.
Now go ahead and do just exactly as I told you.
So there. Curiosity, a fascination with assembling clues or facts into a story, even a certain recklessness. For me, those qualities add up to what it takes to be a reporter. I didn't know that when I was 9 years old. I never imagined I would become a journalist. I only knew that the moment I finished one Nancy Drew mystery, I couldn't wait to plunge into another. To see the original Girl Sleuth in her many incarnations, visit NPR.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro.
Firuzeh Duma's first book, Funny and Farsi, was nominated for a James Thurber Award. Now, she was born in Iran, but her family moved to the United States when she was 7. Her father was an engineer, had gone to Texas A&M, and once met Albert Einstein. She has a new collection of essays out now about her family life, which range from recollections of a pet monkey she had for about 3 hours to feeling out of place in college and touring Iowa with a woman who was once a hostage in Tehran. Her new book is Laughing Without an Accent, Adventures of an Iranian American at Home and Abroad. Firuzeh Duma, who's also an occasional NPR commentator, joins us now from Palo Alto, California. Thanks so much for being with us.
No, thank you for having me, Scott.
You are so funny. Why is it that when you came to the United States, you could never understand what was so funny about a pie in the face?
Well, you know, we used to watch television nonstop, and that was the one thing that we never understood, because a pie thrown in someone's face to us just seemed like such a terrible waste of a pie. And yet the laugh tracks would always tell us that it was supposed to be very funny. But I still don't get that.
I love the stories in here about your father, who just sounds like a wonderful man. He wears suits on an airplane, blue velour leisure suits for special occasions. But what's the blue leisure suit preoccupation that he has? Because, I mean, he asks you to shop for blue leisure suits all over.
A few years ago, my uncle Nematullah went to Las Vegas and he bought this blue velour leisure suit. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, this just caught on with all the males in my family. And they would stand around at family gatherings and they would be touching each other's forearms and commenting, oh, wow, this is really thick velour. Look, it doesn't even wrinkle. And they would just have conversations, endless conversations about the qualities of blue velour pantsuits. And my father has so many of them, and they all look exactly alike to me. Mm-hmm. But apparently there is a lot of nuance between different types.
But he will wear a full suit and tie on an airplane.
Always. You know, my dad's in his 80s, and to him, flying is a special occasion. So he always wears a suit on airplanes. And he's always very polite to the flight attendants, and he always thanks them for whatever they bring him, which is not very much these days on airplanes. Yeah. But nonetheless, you know, he'll get the cup of coffee, and he says, oh, this is very good coffee. Thank you very much.
I want to ask about your days as a U.S. college student. You went to Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley.
I did.
And didn't feel as if you exactly fit in.
No, because I thought that when I went to Berkeley, it would be a whole bunch of really smart kids sitting around having interesting conversations. And as a freshman, I discovered it was a lot of smart kids drinking. And it's not that I had anything against drinking, but it's not like the European way of enjoying a glass of wine. It's drinking so they don't remember the weekend, which seems really stupid to me. So I kept looking for groups that didn't drink. And like I joined this church group at one point, and I was right, they didn't drink. But then when they found out I was Muslim, they were so excited because they thought, wow, here's a project sent from above. So that idea ended. And I kept going from group to group. And oddly enough, this all changed for me when I met the man who's now my husband, because he's European. He's from France. And his idea of fun was exactly what mine was, which was to go to a movie, go to a foreign movie, go to an ethnic restaurant, and then discuss the movie afterwards for hours. So
he had the most extraordinarily subtle line to you, didn't he? One of your first conversations.
He did. We just recently met, and he said to me, we're actually having a deep conversation. And in the middle of it, he said, well, I thought, he said, you've quite a chest there. And I was very offended. I thought that was a very creepy thing to say in the middle of a conversation about something that has nothing to do with chests. And so I told him that I thought that was very creepy. And then he said, but no, I meant it as a compliment. And I said, well, it's still creepy. And This went back and forth, and then he said, but all I said is, you're quite a jester. So.
Do you always have your mind in the gutter?
But then I told him, though, that he shouldn't use the word jester. I said, nobody in America uses the word jester. So I made him feel like it was his fault.
Tell us how you became a professional writer, because this wasn't a straight path for you.
No, not at all. My father is a storyteller, and he is actually the funniest person that I know. And I never, ever grew up thinking that I was even remotely funny. And when I was about 36 years old, and I had two children by then, I wanted my children to know my stories, just like I knew my father's stories. But because I live in America, and in America, people don't get together with their families all the time the way my extended family does. So I decided I was going to write down my stories. And when my then youngest started kindergarten, I joined a writer's group. And this was after 8 years of being a stay-at-home mom. And I remember that first day in kindergarten so well, because I was the only mom not crying. And I joined this writer's group, and
not crying because you were so glad to have a little peace and quiet?
Listen, 8 years of having someone Velcro to your hip and, you know, getting all of a sudden 2.5 hours to yourself or 3 hours just seemed like a week in Hawaii to me. So, I joined this writer's group, and I started writing these stories about my life. And after September 11th happened, a friend of mine suggested that I should try to get them published because, as she pointed out, there was nothing out there that had anything to do with the Middle East that was remotely funny. Although now there are two books.
Yours and?
Both of mine.
All right, fair enough. You have an essay in here where you're the mother of an adolescent girl. And you say that you're grateful that your daughter doesn't have to wear a headscarf. But you're alarmed at what adolescent girls can sometimes find themselves wearing in this country. If I get you to talk about what happened going clothes shopping.
Well, I just, you know, my daughter is almost 13. And when she was younger, it was fine going clothes shopping because the clothes were appropriate for her age. And around the time she turned about 8 or 9, I noticed that fashions for her were, well, let's just say inappropriate. And it always surprises me that in this country where girls are supposed to be empowered, that the clothing for them is getting them ready for careers at Hooters. So before we go shopping, there's always this lecture I have to give on what I think is appropriate, what I think is inappropriate.
You set down some rules, don't you?
I do.
So well, one rule, in particular.
Well, one rule I had was nothing could be written on the derriere, because I had noticed there was a trend where there were pants that said juicy on the bottom. And, you know, if an adult woman chooses to wear that, that's one thing. But 9, 10, 11-year-old girls, I don't think they really understand the full effect of wearing something that says juicy on the bottom.
Can you tell us about Miss Sandberg, your old teacher?
Oh, I love Mrs. Sandberg. Mrs. Sandberg was my second grade teacher. I still keep in touch with her. She now lives in Utah. And it's so funny because now whenever we talk, she says, oh, call me Bonnie. And I'm always like, no, Mrs. Sandberg. I don't think so.
Yeah.
She was the teacher I had when I came to America when I didn't speak any English. And she really prepared her students ahead of time. She had told them that there was this new student coming who didn't speak the language. And she told the students to be nice to me and to include me in everything. And they did. And I always say it's just amazing the difference that one good teacher can make at a pivotal time in your life.
Yeah.
And I certainly did my part in trying to ingratiate myself with my new American classmates. And I used to always write their names for them on the board in Persian. And in Persian, we write from right to left. So it's very impressive. And the kids would say, ooh, you write backwards. And then all the boys would always chase me at recess, and they'd say, teach us some bad words in your language. But I'll tell you, though, I think I had the last laugh, because one day I said, okay, fine, I'm going to teach you something, but it's so bad, you've got to promise never to repeat it. And they said, okay, we promise. I said, okay, man haram, never repeat that. And, of course, from that day on, they ran around saying, man haram, man haram, man haram, which means I'm an idiot.
Well, all right, so now you're a well-known humorist, and they're probably still running around yelling, I'm an idiot.
Well, I think they're in bars trying to pick up on Iranian women and saying, man haram, and wondering why it's not working.
Well, Firuzeh, very nice talking to you.
Thank you.
Firuzeh Duma. Her new book is Laughing Without an Accent, Adventures of an Iranian American at Home and Abroad.
The year is 1876, and the novelist Henry James and his psychologist brother William are the toast of the East Coast intellectual set. Now, the two younger brothers are thought to be dead after going off to fight in the Civil War some years earlier. But that presumption is wrong. Henry James learns the truth during a fateful train ride on the Missouri Pacific Express bound for St. Louis. The train is brought to a screeching halt by a band of outlaws, and soon it becomes obvious. Two of these bandits are his long-lost brothers, the notorious bank robbers Frank and Jesse James. Now, textbooks seem to have neglected this chapter in American history, so a new book tries to rectify that error. It's called The James Boys, and it's written by Richard Liebman Smith. He joins me now from our New York bureau. Mr. Liebman Smith, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, I'd like to keep this going, but we should get one thing straight right now. This is a joke. Henry and William James were not related to the outlaws Jesse and Frank James.
That is correct. Henry and William were brothers, and Frank and Jesse were brothers, but they were not brothers of each other.
But you've written a book in which the conceit is that they are all related. So how did this idea come about?
Many, many years ago, when I was an undergraduate at Stanford, I had a professor named Otis Pease, who was teaching a course in 19th century American history. And he began by saying, jokingly, that the story of America in the 19th century could be encapsulated in the story of the James brothers, William and Henry in the East and Frank and Jesse in the West. That was the seminal moment. Only later did I learn that, in fact, William and Henry James had two younger brothers. They really did in history. Their names were Robertson and Garth Wilkinson James, and they were not the geniuses that William and Henry were. They fought in the Civil War, however, which William and Henry managed not to do. And after that, they went out west. They lived out west and had wasted horrible lives.
But they were not bank robbers.
They were not bank robbers. That far they did not go. But in this book, they become, Rob and Wilkie become Frank and Jesse.
And in the book, the outlaws, Frank and Jesse James, essentially kidnap the novelist Henry James from the train. And Henry manages to send a letter out to his famous brother, William James, at Harvard, explaining what happened. Can you read that for us?
That's right. This is the beginning of his long tale of woe. He says, "Dearest William, I am afraid that I have neglected writing home longer than has been agreeable to you, but the delay has been inevitable, and when I describe the perfectly infernal circumstances that have stayed my pen, I fancy you will surely forgive my silence. Que vous en dirai-je? In brutal summary, our late soldier brothers, Rob and Wilkie, are neither late nor soldiers. They are very much alive, and they are outlaws, having adopted the prénom de guerre, Jesse and Frank, while retaining our illustrious surname, which they drag through the mud at every criminal outing."
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to give too much of the plot away here, but eventually Henry James gets dragged into the infamous and botched heist at the First National Bank in Northfield, Minnesota. Now, that heist really happened in 1876, and you describe it accurately.
Pretty accurately. Henry was not there,
as far
as I know.
Except, of course, right. Henry James, the novelist, was not there. And he certainly wasn't an accomplice to the crime.
That's right. But you should know that there has been, for many years, a debate about this, because every eyewitness or many eyewitnesses believed that there was a ninth man. There were eight that were ever charged with the crime. But the feeling among many witnesses was that there was a ninth man. Hmm. And now we know who he is.
Henry James.
Henry James.
And in the story, how does Henry James perform as a bank robber?
He's actually not that good at it. He falls into a – first of all, he's not equipped to handle the six guns and the prancing thoroughbred. But the other thing is, he falls into a very observational mode, which was his favorite mode of being. So he doesn't really participate fully in the bank robbery, and that causes a lot of trouble for the gang, which they ultimately pin on him.
Right. Richard Liebman Smith, in this book, at a certain point, it seems as if you're deliberately sort of aping Henry James's own writing style.
That's half true. What I was going for was the kind of flavor of that style, and also the flavor of an overly pompous academic style. So it's not exactly Henry's style, but it's meant to suggest it in a lot of places, especially places where he is involved and describing things or thinking about things. And many of the things that I put into his mind come from his mind. They're things that he wrote sometimes in the language that he wrote them.
Now the book is obviously very well researched. I mean, there's a lot of historical detail in here, and so much, in fact, that it's sometimes hard to tell where the fact and the fiction diverge.
That's correct.
I mean, do you sort of get a kick out of that?
I get a kick out of it. In my mind, it's all true. No, really, I guess I could tell you what's real and what's not, but at this point, they are so blended in my mind that I kind of believe it.
I sometimes found myself sort of thumbing through a history book and going back to the novel, trying to figure out what actually happened. And then a lot of it is historically accurate. How did you do the research for the book? What did you have to do?
I could have gotten a doctorate for what I did. enormous amounts of reading. There's a huge literature on both William and Henry, biographical literature, and also on Frank and Jesse. There are floods of books on both of these brotherhoods. And I, you know, delved into that, and I have a whole shelf at home of, I think, 150 or so books, plus whatever I, you know, scraped out of the library and the internet.
So in this sort of madcap tale of Henry James and William James and Frank and Jesse James sort of encountering one another in different ways, I sort of wonder if you kind of have to be familiar with Henry James's novels or William James's work on psychology or even the capers carried out by Frank and Jesse James in order to sort of get the book.
I don't think that's true, only in the sense that I have been careful, I think, to describe those things, to talk about Henry's books, to talk about William's philosophizing and psychologizing, and to talk about the depredations of Frank and Jesse. But what I hope is that the story, because there really is a story here, and I hope that the story carries people along and they don't have to worry too much about A, you know, what's real and what's not real, and B, whether or not these details are accurate.
Mr. Liebman-Smith, do you suppose that one day an unsuspecting college student might stumble upon the book without knowing that it's a parody, and then you could some sort of read about the brothers Henry and Jesse James on Wikipedia or something someday?
I think that's quite likely. And I'll tell you why. I once wrote a story about the silent film career of Albert Einstein that was published in Playboy magazine many, many years ago. And that happened. There was a student at the University of Chicago who came running to her professor and said, I want to do my master's thesis on the films of Albert Einstein. And she learned, much to her sorrow, that that was not the case. So this, it could happen here. I hope not. I hope it doesn't hurt anybody.
Right. Well, Richard Liebman-Smith, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Richard Liebman-Smith is the author of The James Boys, a novel account of four desperate brothers. It's published by Random House.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.